So let's generate our motivation. And so as it's snowing now, we can think that each snowflake is a Vajrasattva falling down on us, merging into us, helping to purify our body, speech, and mind. We can think that the snowflake Vajrasattvas are raining down on all the sentient beings all around us. The turkeys and the quails and the deer, the chickadees, and in that way, you know, with a loving attitude, wishing all these sentient beings well, wanting their minds to be purified of all defilements, to be imbued with all the qualities of the Buddha. And then you can think of the snowflakes, Vajrasattva, raining down on the hot hells, cooling them off, raining down on the cold hells and heating them up. And Vajrasattva is going everywhere in the universe, touching all the sentient beings, alleviating their pain and their obscurations. So with confidence in Vajrasattva's ability to guide us and confidence in our ability to follow the path, then let's do our best to make that visualization a reality. So we did the first two paragraphs of chapter 5 last time, I think. And we'll take off from there. But first, Venerable Jamba did her homework. It's homework. So I thought I'd go through some of this. She said some interesting things. So she said, you pointed out these past weeks quite frequently the importance of cherishing others. In my daily reflections and meditation on the 7-point mind training, that's one of the main topics. And there's so much to say about this, but basically, why or when I'm not able to go forward is because I can't admit that I'm self-centered. Does that ring a bell with anybody? It takes a lot of courage to admit that I am lazy, that I think of myself first, or that I am jealous because I think I am more important, and so forth. Anybody else have that problem? Yeah? Oh, this is a common problem, and so this is what really interferes for all of us. How much time do I spend considering other situations, their troubles, their perspectives, their feelings? I only see them in a very narrow light because I'm always in my head. It's always about me, my needs and wants. So I thought the way she phrased that was so interesting. It's always in my head. my needs, my wants, my likes, my dislikes. And there you see the conceptual mind at work in not a beneficial way, but in a quite harmful way. Yeah. And we really are in our head, you know, at those times. And we walk around in our life looking at people and so on, but we're so preoccupied spinning around, you know, oh, how is my health? Am I sleeping enough? Am I eating enough? I feel happy. I feel sad. This person didn't smile at me. My knees hurt. My back hurts. How many more mantras do I have to do? I don't know. I'm trying to study this and then I forget it. All the time. Do you have this just nonstop? Yeah, nonstop. And it really is in our head, isn't it? You know, you're walking around, you're seeing the deer and the chickadees. Once in a while, you see a human being, but they fade into the background like the deers and the chickadees. You know, we pay more attention to the turkeys because, you know, they're quite amusing. But mostly we're in our head, just, you know, going round and round, round, round about me and my situation. Do people like me? Do they not like me? What do they think of me? Do I fit in here? Do I like them? No, I don't fit in here. I've never fit in anywhere I've gone. How come I never fit in any place? The world always excludes me from everything. Oh, this is the world supposed to be kind, and I don't know. Every time I look at people, I'm excluded, and I don't fit in. They don't like me, and how am I ever going to do this? And I'm supposed to love all sentient beings, but I really can't stand their guts. But I can't admit that to anybody because I'm a Buddhist, and I'm supposed to be a nice Buddhist. Yeah. That going on? Okay, so, you know, why can't we cherish others? Because all of our attention is just spinning around ourselves at every possible instance and occasion. Yeah? Okay, so we are in our heads like that. But rather, when I see others, I see them as a potential threat to my ego instead of as a human being who seeks happiness and does not want to suffer. Yeah? When you look at other sentient beings, is your instant reaction like, are they helping me or are they going to harm me? Yeah? How do you relate to sentient beings? What's your MO? What's the filter through which you filter everything? Yeah. Oh, there's a sentient being. Are they going to take up my time or are they going to let me go? Are they going to help me or are they going to harm me? Are they going to give me a present or are they going to take my stuff away? Are they going to praise me or are they going to blame me? You know, we all have different things through which we scan the environment and the people in it. And again, we're in our head and we're not able to see them as sentient beings who want happiness and don't want to suffer. Yeah. Or as, you know, somebody who's been our kind mother in previous lives and has taken care of us. You know, because we're so filled with all this other stuff. So my narrow mind that thinks of herself most of the day puts on this protection shield of me first and foremost. And that's what it is, isn't it? You know, in Tantra, we some practices, we have a protection wheel, and we imagine all the, you know, the light or the whatever it's made out of, okay, protecting us. Yeah, but it's to protect us from afflictions, mostly our own afflictions, okay? But we make our own protection wheel to protect us from the kind sentient beings. Yeah, because we don't see them as kind sentient beings. We see them as possible threats. Or if they're not possible threats, then they're possible people we can use. You know, we can use them to get what we want. So maybe they'll give us things, maybe they'll praise us, but how can I use them to benefit myself?
When you talk about filters, is it a matter of, like, we're not having the right filters on, because the right filter is to see them as beings who want happiness and don't want to suffer, because that is also a filter. And is that what they call the generic image that we see them through? Because we don't actually see them.
Yeah. I think what we're trying to do is see them in a realistic way. And, of course, because it's conceptual thoughts, you know, then there's generic images, there's conceptual appearances going on. But seeing them as a kind sentient being or as somebody who wants happiness and doesn't want suffering, that's an accurate way to see others, whereas our usual filters are inaccurate ways, okay? Because an accurate way, we would not have a filter, okay? It's just, I'm open, and they're sentient beings, and, you know, how can I relate to them, and what, how, you know, we're together in samsara and need to help each other. And that's, you know, without, there's still conceptual images, but there's not a filter, whereas these other kinds of things, are they going to help me? Are they harm me? Are they going to praise me? Can I use them? Are they going to use me? Are they going to manipulate me? God, I hate being manipulated. Why do all these people manipulate me? I've got, I should learn to stand up for myself more, but I never can. And, you know, all that is, you know, the self-centered filter. Yeah. And so we just pick out a few criteria that are not who those sentient beings are, but look at them through that criteria. Okay, so that's what I'm meaning by filter. But when I serve others, for example, right now I'm serving Venerable Jigme, or sometimes I have the opportunity to serve you, then I am happy because I'm not thinking of myself. My mind is open and joyful. Doing something for others is getting me out of my self-centered mind. And that's precisely the point, yeah? But thinking of myself, for example, when standing in the food line and wondering whether putting some food for Venerable Jigme together and taking it to her, will there be enough for me after I return from bringing it? My mind gets narrow and unhappy, especially when indeed certain food is already gone when I come back from giving Venerable Jigme her food. But I remember your Tibetan story. Remember the one about the monk and the puja when they were passing out curd? And he was, you know, like lusting for curd and eat, you know, as it went down the line and wondering if there was going to be enough when they got to him. And when it finally got to him, he said, no thanks, I've been eating a lot of curd, because he ate everybody else's mentally in the line before him. So, so she was remembering that story. This is what I try to practice these days when it's my turn to take part at the lunch table, because every day I am the last person who gets her fill. When I am actually able to practice this, being content with whatever is left, I discover that my mind is happy. There's a certain mental strength that comes with it. Then I can also see the kindness and effort of the cooks. of the cooks and the energy they put in the food and the sponsors for donating the food and the farmers who grow and harvest the food. And I am grateful to all who recognize that there is a line after them. I am thankful for that, and this kindness of others brightens my mind. Okay, so this is a really good practice to recognize the craving mind and find ways to work with it, because I don't want to be unhappy or make others unhappy with my behavior either. It's a good practice to recognize the kindness of others, to cherish others, even though they eat all the food before I got there. Okay, so this is really putting the Dharma in practice. Yeah? Kind of noticing your afflictions when it's coming up and applying an antidote. And sometimes more successful applying the antidote. Sometimes we just need more familiarization with the antidote. Okay? But this is exactly what Dharma practice is it's about working with our mind. Okay? It's not about, you know, wearing robes and, you know, shaving your head and, you know, where you stand in the lunch line and these kinds of things. It's about transforming the mind. Okay. Well done. Even though you're starving.
No, I know.
Yeah. Because, you know, sometimes I'm the last one, not you, and indeed.
They put all the stuff in your bowls and get cleaned.
Not always. But you see, they make dal and chickpeas and beans, and I can't eat any of those. And then they have rice, which I don't eat either.
I told you I'm self-sheltered.
Yeah. Yeah, you shouldn't think about me. And I don't eat cabbage, but every time they make cabbage, I rejoice because Venerable Yeshe loves cabbage. Yeah, so, I don't know. Maybe we can cry together.
No, I love that.
Then I'll just sit there and cry.
I'm sure you can find someone else to cry with.
Oh, yeah. There's no shortage. You want to cry with me? What don't you eat? Yeah, everybody here doesn't eat something at the lunch line, isn't it? You know? And we always feel, oh, I'll get there. The food that I do eat, it's gone. Woe is me. Why don't they have a special cart just with my name on it? Because even on the special cart, I have to share what's in there. And if I'm the first person, I can't take very much because then I feel guilty. There won't be enough for the people who come after me. And if I'm the last person, then there isn't enough because the people who came before me ate it all. I want my own cart.
You got it.
Oh, please.
I'm showing up on UPS truck tomorrow.
What?
We got a new cart. The black one. We got a new one.
We got a new cart.
We got a new cart? Who got a new cart? Who ordered a new cart?
The operations team. It's within their framework.
What's wrong with the old cart?
It was a leaf decision.
A leaf?
Leaf decision.
Leaf. Oh, I see.
Not a branch.
Not a branch. It was a leaf decision. Okay. I give up. It's okay. I know. Actually, I got a compliment when Venerable Gache was here. We were talking about how the people in the community have changed over the years and how she can really see the people's change, the change in the people from living and practicing here. And she said also that I don't micromanage as much. How much did that card cost?
It was covered.
How much did the card cost?
Yeah. It was under 600.
So that means the harmonizers decided it. I trust the harmonizers because you're cheap like me. Oh, not cheap, we're frugal. We're very frugal.
Might be a bit of both.
On the section on the three turnings of the Dharma wheel. I think you better get to work here. Turning the Dharma wheel refers to the Buddha giving teachings that lead sentient beings to temporary happiness within cyclic existence and to the highest goodness of liberation and full awakening. From the perspective of the Sanskrit tradition, as described in the Sutra Unraveling the Thought, the Buddha turned the Dharma wheel three times, with each turning primarily addressing the needs of a specific group of disciples. So this is something put forth by the Sanskrit tradition, not by the Pali tradition. The teachings of the first turning of the Dharma wheel form the foundation of Buddhist practice for all three vehicles. What are the three vehicles? Shraka, solitary realizer, bodhisattva. Okay. At the same time, the three turnings fulfill the specific needs. Oh, no, we're talking about the first turning. Yeah. The first turning fulfills the specific needs of shravakas who seek personal liberation. The first turning began with the Buddha's first discourse at Deer Park in Sarnath, India, during which he delineated the main framework for training the mind in the four truths of the Aryas. When describing the fourth truth, the truth of the path, he taught the 37 aids to awakening, which establish procedures for putting the four truths into practice. The 37 harmonies. It had a name change. The 37 harmonies relate to two primary methods of training, the first leading to serenity, single-pointedness of mind, the second bringing forth insight or deep understanding. To put these 37 in the context of the three higher trainings, yeah, and this is how it's very good, you know, if you can see how all the items in these different lists, how they fit in with each other and complement each other, then it really helps you to understand the path and how things get put together. To put these 37 in the context of the three higher trainings, we begin practicing the higher training in ethical conduct to eliminate coarse negativities of body and speech. On this basis, we cultivate serenity in the higher training of concentration and insight in the higher training of wisdom. The 37 harmonies can be divided into seven sets. Okay, so the four establishments of mindfulness, the four supreme strivings, the four bases of supernormal power, the five faculties, five powers, seven awakening factors, and the Eightfold Noble Path. Okay, so those are the seven groups, each with various numbers that add up to 37. Vasubandhu and the Treasury of Knowledge and Asanga in Compendium of Knowledge correlate their full-fledged full-fledged practice with successive levels of the five paths. In that context, they are set out sequentially. The following is Vasubandhu's presentation. Okay, so Asanga and Vasubandhu, their presentation is very similar, except the last two sets they reversed. But here's how, those seven sets are, fit in with the five paths. So the first set is the four establishments of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. As we deepen our practice of these four, we will gain greater enthusiasm and vigor to engage in wholesome activities. This leads us to make great effort in the four supreme strivings. The four supreme strivings are all forms of effort. Okay, and they are to abandon non-virtues already generated, prevent destructive actions in the future, enhance virtues that have already been generated, and generate new virtues in the future. Okay? So we're really going into depth here, looking at the true path, okay, the fourth of the four truths. By engaging in ethical conduct, such as avoiding destructive actions and enhancing and engaging in constructive ones, we will develop a certain clarity of mind and single-pointedness. This leads us to practice the third set, the four bases of spiritual power, aspiration, effort, intention, and investigation, which are four methods to enhance our capability to remain focused single-pointedly on a chosen object of meditation. So those four bases of spiritual power are all concentrations. Okay. When we have single-pointed concentration, okay, that can last for prolonged periods of time, all of our other, so that's the higher training in concentration, all of our other virtuous spiritual faculties will be enhanced. We will increase the five powers, faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, and the five forces, the strengthening of those same five qualities. In the next volume, I may have reversed the translations for forces and powers. We'll see. When these forces are fully developed, we will progress to practice the seven awakening factors. So here, what he's doing, he's looking very much at the fourth truth, okay, and tying it in with the three higher trainings, but showing how the 37 harmonies with awakening, which are all fit into the fourth truth, you know, as do the three higher trainings. They're all ways to look at the fourth truth. How these seven sets of, that fit into the harmonies, how one leads to the next one. That's what he's showing, okay? So you have the four establishments of mindfulness that gives you a lot of information about the base you're working with, the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. Then you go into the four supreme strivings, the four bases of spiritual power, okay? So the four supreme strivings are mental factors of effort. The four bases of spiritual power are concentration. As, you're doing all this on the basis of ethical conduct, then that increases the five powers, faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, and the five forces, which are those same five, but enhanced. And when we talk about sharp faculty disciples and modest faculty disciples, those faculties are those five forces and five powers, whether those are strong or weak in somebody. Okay. So do you remember about sharp faculty disciples, what they do?
They realize emptiness before they realize bodhicitta.
Yeah. Okay. Why?
Because they
know enlightenment is possible.
Hmm?
They need to know enlightenment is possible.
Yeah, they need to know enlightenment's possible. And so they focus on realizing emptiness. And then when they know, when they have an inferential understanding of emptiness, they know awakening's possible, then they generate bodhicitta and enter the bodhisattva path. Okay. When these five forces are fully developed, we will progress to practice the seven awakening factors. Correct mindfulness, all these have the name correct before them. Correct mindfulness, correct discrimination of phenomena, correct effort, correct rapture. I changed that term to joy. The correct pliancy, correct concentration, and correct equanimity. This leads us to fully follow the core of the Buddhist path, the Eightfold Noble Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Okay, and that Eightfold Path can be subsumed in the three higher trainings. Okay, so through practicing the 37 harmonies, our minds will be transformed and we will attain liberation from cyclic existence. Okay, so that's the first turning of the Dharma wheel. And there's a lot in it, okay? And, you know, the reason he spelled all this out, I think, is because often people who practice the Mahayana, they think, oh, there's not much in the Pali tradition, you know? But when you look at this, there's a lot, okay? And it's very helpful to meditate on it. And all of this is in Volume 4, which will be out in October, and it's entitled Following the Footsteps of the Buddha.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Okay, now that's the first turning of the Dharma wheel. So you can see how it really sets the basis for everything.
Does the Tibetan tradition put much emphasis on delineating these out in the same way, or is it, I know there's a lot of emphasis on the three higher trainings, but do you mm-hmm. get that kind of detail?
You get it when you study the ornament of clear realizations. Uh-huh. But still, even there, sometimes they go through it rather quickly. But, you know, for example, with the four establishments of mindfulness, sometimes, you know, when they're talking about the bodhisattva path, because it comes in the fourth bhumi, those bhumis, you know, those bodhisattvas, you know, gain a special knowledge of the 37 harmonies. And so sometimes they go through those quickly. But Jetsun Chuki Gyaltsen wrote something on the four establishments of mindfulness. And that's what I used when I taught it some years ago. Okay. So that is there. I don't know how many people study it. And when I was going through it with His Holiness, he said that he was sad that a lot of people in the Tibetan tradition didn't practice that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really agree. I think it's quite valuable, that practice. Okay. The second turning of the Wheel of Dharma contains the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the Buddha's teachings on the perfection of wisdom. Elaborating on the topic of selflessness that the Buddha described briefly in the first turning, here he explains that all phenomena are empty of inherent existence. Okay, so talking about selflessness, he did briefly in the first turning. Here he's going into it in more depth. And of the four truths, the second turning is really emphasizing true cessations, you know, and emptinesses are true cessations. And then the third turning of the Dharma wheel is emphasizing the mind, the subject that realizes emptiness. So it's the third turning is emphasizing the true paths. Mm-hmm. and you know, kind of fleshing it out, things that the Buddha didn't give great detail out in the first turning, then he gave much more detail in the second, third on these two topics. You know, because that's what we want to actualize, the true paths and true cessations. So, elaborating on the topic of selflessness that the Buddha described briefly in the first turning, here in the second turning, he explains that all phenomena are empty of inherent existence. He also clarifies the meaning of the truth of cessation as the emptiness of a mind from which defilements have been eradicated. Okay, so there's how the Buddha is defining true cessations, okay? It's the emptiness of inherent existence of a mind that has had defilements eradicated. Mm-hmm. Giving an extensive explanation of the six perfections, generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude, joyous effort, meditative stability, and wisdom, the second turning also elaborates on the truth of the path for bodhisattvas. So the principal and appropriate audience for the sutras in the second turnings of the Dharma wheel are spiritual aspirants who understand the teachings in the first turning and, in addition, aspire for the full awakening of Buddhahood. So remember, the first turning was given specifically for the Shravakas. That doesn't mean other people didn't benefit and they weren't in the audience. They certainly would. And that's why we all practice the material in the first turning of the Dharma wheel, yeah, even though we're Mahayana practitioners. Okay, and the second turning was the principal audience was bodhisattvas, but there were also Shravakas and other beings in the audience too. Okay, so principal doesn't mean only. Okay. Although those who have understood the first turning and aspire for full awakening, although they are not the primary, that they doesn't refer to those bodhisattvas, okay? It refers to the Shravakas that's coming. Although they are not the primary audience, these teachings are also for those who seek personal liberation because a comprehensive explanation of emptiness is indispensable for all practitioners. Many of these sutras were taught at Vulture's Peak near Rajagriha in India. Okay. So there's a lot of terms and a lot of information here. Yeah, what you may want to do is go through and, you know, draw up something up. First turning, second turning, third turning, principal audience, principal topics, list what was taught, you know, in that so that you have it clear in your mind. Okay. The third turning, you know, if I made all the charts, then you wouldn't have to learn it. Okay. The third turning of the Dharma wheel contains two categories of sutras. The first furnishes further explanation of the truth of the path and presents a different interpretation of the Prajnaparamita's sutra's statement that all phenomena are empty of inherent existence. Okay, so this is the Chittamatra or Yogacharya interpretation. These third turning sutras were taught primarily to benefit those trainees who, although inclined towards the bodhisattva path, are not yet suitable vessels for the teaching on the absence of inherent existence. If they were to embrace the literal meaning of the Prajnaparamita sutras, they would fall into nihilism by mistakenly thinking that emptiness means the total non-existence of phenomena. For their benefit, the Buddha spoke of naturelessness, okay, in relation to three different natures of phenomena. Do you remember that? Yeah? So the dependent nature, the imputed nature, and the consummate nature. So the dependent nature, those are all things that are dependent, you know, the house, the person, all these things, things that arise dependently. The imputed phenomena are things that are created conceptually. And within imputed phenomena, you have some that exist and some that don't exist. So the ones that exist would be like unconditioned space. Okay, the ones that don't exist would be the a self-sufficient, substantially existent person, an inherently existent blender, you know, these kinds of things. And the consummate nature is the ultimate nature. Okay. And so remember, they talk about two kinds of ultimate natures. Rather than think that all phenomena, without exception, are empty of inherent existence, the Buddha taught these trainees that different phenomena are empty of different kinds of natures. Okay. This category includes sutras such as the Sutra Unraveling the Thought. Okay, so do you want to go into those different kinds of natures to review it a little bit? Yeah?
Question is, you were talking about the imputed nature.
Mm-hmm.
Some exist, some don't.
Yeah.
But the example of ones that don't, you mentioned an inherently existent blender, but I thought they don't refute inherent existence in this system.
Oh.
Is it, should be a true, no.
Yeah, you're right. It should be a, you're right. It should be a blender that exists that exists independent of the mind that cognizes it, that arises, how do you say it? That arises is a different substantial nature than the mind that cognizes it. Yes, thank you for pointing that out. Okay, so that's what the one of the imputational natures that doesn't exist.
I'm trying to remember the terms that Jeffrey uses to translate this in my head. These three terms are different.
The three natures?
Yeah.
Three kinds of phenomena? No, I think.
Other powered.
Yeah.
And thoroughly established.
And thoroughly established. Okay, yeah. Okay. Okay. So, do you want to do a big review or a small review?
Big.
Okay. So, let's talk about those three phenomena to start out. So, the dependent or other-powered nature are functioning things. They're called other-powered because they arise in dependence on the respective latencies, in this case, the latency of a similar type, and because they do not last a second moment. They have the function of arising due to causes and being the basis for consummate natures. They're the basis upon which you realize the ultimate nature. They may be impure, such as the five aggregates, or pure, such as the meditative equipoise, directly realizing emptiness, and the wisdom of subsequent attainment that follows that. Okay, the wisdom of subsequent attainment is pure in that it is influenced by the direct perceiver of emptiness, but it's mistaken in that things appear to be a different entity from the consciousness that perceives them. So what's interesting is for the Yogacarya, the object of negation appears to the sense consciousness, just as it does for the Prasangika. For the Svatantrika, the object of negation does not appear to the sense consciousnesses. Okay. So dependent things exist by their own characteristics, and they truly exist. They have some nature, inherent nature in them. Okay, the imputed or imaginary nature are imputed by conception. Some of them do not exist. For example, a turtle's mustache, the self of persons, the self of phenomena, external objects, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and what else? You know, the flood of rapists and drug dealers flowing into the country in the south border. Those are examples of the imaginary nature that does not exist. Okay? As well as things existing by their own characteristics as the referent of words and concepts about them, because things do not exist by their own nature, by their own characteristics as the reference for words and concepts. Other imputed natures do exist, for example, unconditioned space and other permanent phenomena. Imaginaries do not exist by their own characteristics, but they exist for thought. So they're quite different from the dependent or other-powered. Yeah. Then the third nature is the consummate or thoroughly established nature. So that is a suchness that is the emptiness of external objects. That is the emptiness of subject and object arising from different substantial entities. Or the second kind of emptiness is the emptiness of an object existing by its own characteristics as the referent for the name. Okay. The ultimate nature is called thoroughly established because it is one nature with the dependent phenomena, that phenomenon that is its basis and has been there with the object from the start. This is the ultimate nature, the selflessness of persons and the selflessness of phenomena as expounded by the Yogacharyans. These also exist by their own characteristics. And so here the ultimate nature truly exists. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. But that makes sense because, you know, we often think, you know, even though we know better, you know, that emptiness is some kind of absolute truth that exists somewhere unrelated to anything else. Yeah. So we also have that, you know, us common beings, that mistaken idea of the ultimate nature being truly existent. Yeah, we reify even that. Okay, then the Chidamajans assert different types of existence for those three natures. Okay, so other powered or dependent natures, such as blue and the visual consciousness perceiving it, they truly exist, they ultimately exist, they exist by their own characteristics, they inherently exist, and they exist from their own side. So they are, but so that's interesting because they're real, but they're not real in the sense that they're not a different substance from the consciousness perceiving them. They're one nature with that consciousness, and they arise from the same latency as that consciousness. Yeah. So somehow they have it. The way the Chidamajans are thinking, there's something they have some essence that is theirs, but you know they're not separate from the consciousness perceiving them. Yeah, they don't have their own substantial nature that's different than the consciousness. Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, when you look around, do things look to you like they're, you know, one nature with your mind that's perceiving them? No, they're out there, you know, some external object. Okay, the non-existent imaginaries, just as the flowers existing as a separate entity from the consciousness perceiving it, or the flowers existing by its own characteristics as the referent of the name, yeah, or the hordes of rapists and murderers flowing in from the southern border, these non-existent imaginaries do not exist at all, period. the existent imaginaries, okay, such as unconditioned space, and the flowers being a referent of terms and conceptions, okay? So the flower being the referent of terms and conceptions, that exists. The flowers being the referent of the terms and concepts by its own characteristics does not exist. Okay? So these existent imaginaries don't truly exist or ultimately exist. No, they don't truly exist, ultimately exist, exist by their own characteristics. Okay, so they don't exist in any of those three ways, the existent imaginaries. But they do exist for conceptual consciousness, and they also exist inherently and from their own side. Okay, consummate natures, such as the non-existence of the imaginary nature in a dependent nature, okay, are the three selflessnesses. So they have one selflessness of person and two selflessnesses of phenomena in Chittamatra. So the first, the absence of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person, is the selflessness of persons. So that's one consummate nature. The second and third consummate natures, the absence of form and so forth existing by their own characteristics as the objects of the terms and concepts of them, and the absence of form and so forth existing as a different entity from the consciousness perceiving them, those two are the selflessness of phenomena. Okay. So the consummate natures truly exist, ultimately exist, exist by their own characteristics, inherently exist, and exist from their own side. Yeah. So it's interesting. So the consummate nature, which is the negation of what doesn't exist that we think exists, exists inherently. Then the imaginaries. Okay, so this is the part that we were at when we were talked here, when he said, the Buddha spoke of the naturelessness in relation to different natures of phenomena. Okay, so here's the naturelessness of those three groups. So imaginaries are character natureless, in that they are imputed by thought and do not exist by their own characteristics. So that's kind of, we can understand that. They're totally made up by thought. They don't exist by their own characteristics. So they're character natureless. Dependent natures are natureless in two ways. Okay, so first way is they are production natureless, in that they are not produced by themselves, but are produced due to causes and conditions. Okay? That is, they lack a nature of being produced randomly or without causes and conditions. So for that reason, they're called production natureless. Okay? They're also called ultimate natureless, because they are not the consummate nature, okay? They are not the final nature of phenomena that is perceived by the ultimate purifying consciousness, okay? Because they're false. They appear in one way and they exist in another way. Okay, the consummate natures are also ultimate natureless, but in a different sense. So the dependent natures were ultimate natureless because they weren't the consummate nature. Okay? The consummate nature is ultimate natureless because it is ultimate naturelessness. It's the actual ultimate nature of phenomena. their emptiness of the two imaginary natures that is perceived by the ultimate purifying consciousness. So ultimate in ultimate natureless refers to existing in the two imaginary ways mentioned above, the subject and object of cognition being different entities, and a phenomena existing by its own characteristics as the referent of words and concepts about them. Okay, yeah, so that's the meaning of ultimate in consummate nature, is that they're empty of those two kind of imaginary natures. And consummate natures are natureless of existing in that way. That is a quick review. If you haven't studied it before, you didn't know what we're talking about. Okay? Even if you did study it before, you may have forgotten it and you still don't know what we're talking about. Okay? But it's a very succinct review. Yeah? I'm reading from a chapter in a future volume. Okay. My cheat sheet.
Thank you. Yeah. You have to suck it through three volumes. Oh, it made me want to read it.
Okay. Okay. So the second category of sutras comprising the third turning, because remember there's two categories of sutras in the third turning. Okay, those ones that expounded the Chittamatra view for the disciples that are inclined towards the Bodhisattva path, but they aren't receptive to understanding the emptiness of inherent existence because they could misinterpret it and think that nothing exists at all. So that was the first group of the audience for the third turning. Okay, then the second one. Okay, this category includes sutras such as the Tathagata Essence Sutra, Tathagata Garbha Sutra, which is the basis for Maitreya's Sublime Continuum and Nagarjuna's Collection of Praises. The third turning of the Wheel of Dharma was taught at Vaisali and other places in India. Its main audience was both those seeking liberation and those seeking full awakening. Okay. And that those teachings go into great detail about the true path and about the consciousness realizing emptiness. And if you are reading volume 3 in the last few chapters about Buddha nature, His Holiness really talks about how this group of sutras in the third turning is leading people into Tantra. Okay, by talking about what kind of mind is it that realizes emptiness. Okay. To summarize, so the third turning does not mention Tantra. It doesn't mention the fundamental innate mind of clear light. But by the way it presents the true path, it makes people question, you know, well, what is that mind? You know, what is that ultimate mind that really realizes the ultimate nature? And then that's what leads them into Tantra. To summarize, the first turning of the Wheel of Dharma laid out the basic framework of the Buddhist path to awakening, the four truths of the Aryas. The second turning went into greater depth on the third truth, the truth of cessation, which needs to be understood in the context of the ultimate nature of the mind, its emptiness of inherent existence. In addition to having the correct view of the emptiness of the mind as presented in the second turning, a profound subject, a yogic mind that has ceased defilements, is needed. This leads to further discussion in the third turning of the fourth truth, the truth of the path, the mind that realizes the nature of reality and eradicates defilements. Okay, By combining our understanding of the wisdom realizing emptiness as presented in the second turning of the Dharma wheel, and an understanding of Buddha nature and the nature of mind as presented in the third turning of the Dharma wheel, we can gain genuine conviction in the possibility of attaining true cessation through actualizing true path. Some sutras in the third turning of the wheel of Dharma speak of Buddha nature and the subjective experience of emptiness, thus establishing the basis for the Vajrayana teachings, which emphasize employing the subtlest mind to realize emptiness. In this way, the earlier teachings of the Buddha lay the foundation for topics that are developed more fully in later teachings, and the sutras of the three turnings of the Dharma wheel complement each other. Okay? So it is really showing here that the Buddha, the way the Buddha taught the Dharma, there was a plan in mind, and, you know, making sure that different disciples who had different capabilities got the teachings that they needed that would ultimately lead them to the final view and ultimately lead them to Tantra. And why leading to Tantra? Because Tantra is the one that talks about the fundamental innate mind of clear light. And if you can make that mind arise and use that to realize emptiness, then you can eliminate obscurations very quickly. The teachings of the first Dharma wheel, which emphasize the practices of the fundamental vehicle, form the core of the Pali tradition. Based on these teachings, the Buddha taught the second and third Dharma wheels, which form the heart of the Sanskrit tradition. The form of Buddhism that flourished in Tibet comprises all of these teachings. For these reasons, we Tibetans believe that it is a comprehensive form of the Buddha Dharma because it includes all the essential teachings of the fundamental vehicle, Mahayana and Vajrayana. In the fundamental vehicle, selflessness generally refers to the lack of a soul, a self that is permanent, unitary, and independent, or a self-sufficient, substantially existent person, a person who is different from the aggregates and is the controller of the body and mind. On the foundation of these teachings, the Mahayana describes the development of bodhicitta and the extensive practices of the bodhisattvas. In addition to the selflessness of persons, it teaches the selflessness of phenomena in detail. The special techniques described in the Vajrayana scriptures enhance these bodhisattva practices. Okay, so he's laying out the whole story in five pages. Okay? And so they say that the sign of a good teacher is somebody who can explain the whole thing succinctly, and then can also explain it elaborately. So this is what His Holiness does, you know? And he's not afraid. I mean, he'll go into this much detail in a public audience in New York City with people who have no clue of what he's talking about, you know, except a few people who have some Dharma background. And he'll do that, and the nobody walks out. They sit there and they listen. And then he'll go from that into talking about the need to have compassion, you know, and he'll weave in and out between all these topics, some of which are very easy to understand and some are very difficult to understand. And he goes in and out of them in one Dharma talk. It's really quite phenomenal. Let me read the next paragraph and then we'll do your question. Without a foundation in the core teachings of the fundamental vehicle, proclaiming oneself to be a follower of the Mahayana is meaningless. That is a powerful statement. Okay? We need a broad, inclusive understanding of the Buddhist teachings to avoid generating mistaken notions. Without doing so, we risk disparaging the teachings of the Buddha by saying either that they are limited in scope or that they are not authentic. It is important to understand that these vehicles and their teachings complement each other. We should embody the essence of all of these teachings in our personal practice. Okay, so one more thing. So here he's really emphasizing, too, that all of these teachings come from the Buddha. And so it's important to respect all of them, you know. And so that explains why there's one, you know, one of the root bodhisattva vows, not to disparage any of the Dharma teachings and not to disparage the Mahayana in particular. Because if you do that and say they aren't the teachings of the Buddha and then you make up something else that you says are, that's what's considered abandoning the Dharma. Okay, and that's very heavy negative karma. Yeah.
I have heard you wrong, so I just want to clarify. So the self-sufficient, substantially existent person is not something that is separate from the aggregates, right?
It is something that is separate from the aggregates. There's two ways of describing the self-sufficient, substantially existent person, okay? There's a gross form and a subtle form. The gross form is a person that is a separate entity from the aggregates. When you describe it that way, the question arises, what then is the difference between that and the soul that the non-Buddhists do? Okay? But that is the coarse form. The subtle form is something that is like the controller of the aggregates, but is one nature with the aggregates. But when I was writing in, I think it was volume 3, maybe volume 4, and I was talking about it, the self-sufficient one, as the controller of the aggregates, Geshe-la stopped and said, no, you have to put as a self that's different from the aggregates, yeah, which is the coarse one.
Just a quick follow-up on that.
So when you say one nature with the aggregates, is it like one of the aggregates is in charge? Is that the subtle one or something different?
It just means that it doesn't exist separately from the aggregates. So that's the subtle one. The gross one is the idea that there's a self that is separate from the aggregates, okay? Which is very much what the non-Buddhists assert.
I'm curious why he would use the breakdown of fundamental vehicle Mahayana and Vajrayana. Because it makes it sound like Vajrayana is not part of Mahayana.
Yeah.
I'm just surprised.
I think because he's saying he wants to, you know, he's not because Vajrayana is a separate thing, but because when you're talking about the three turnings, the last turning will lead you into the Vajrayana. Okay. And also because a lot of people practice it. So he wants people to know that, you know, you have to practice the fundamental vehicle and Mahayana to practice Vajrayana. I think that's it. It's not a separate tradition. Yeah. Although many people think it is, and I bet you some Tibetans think that too. Yeah, hopefully not many. Yeah.
And also there are whole schools of Buddhism, like the Chinese, that practice Mahayana, but don't practice Tantra or Vajrayana. So, and many of them don't. They see it as something totally different. They don't understand that.
Yeah.
Like,
Tibetans. Most of the people who don't practice Vajrayana see Vajrayana as not only something that's totally different than fundamental vehicle in Mahayana, but they see it as phony. And they say it's, you know, it's not really the teachings of the Buddha. And, I mean, there's just so much misunderstanding. Yeah. Yeah. So you just have to be ready. You know, when you're in circles with people who, you know, are not Tibetan or Shingon practitioners, you know, you have to be ready to explain the misunderstandings people have about Vajrayana because they're very widespread. Yeah. And I think that also is why it's so important, you know, why at the Abbey we're really learning Vinaya, because if you behave properly, then those other people from the different schools will trust you when you say that Vajrayana isn't about drinking and sex. But if you don't keep Vinaya properly, then they'll say, oh yeah, look, this is, you know, that's Tibetan tradition and that's what they do. Okay. And, you know, if you are mostly in Tibetan circles, you don't hear the criticism and the misconceptions. But I happen, you know, when you teach in Southeast Asia, you know, there's all the different traditions there and people come to you and ask questions. And here too, you know, at our monastic gatherings.
The Mahayana traditions that don't practice Tantra,
mm-hmm.
do they also believe that it's the fundamental innate mind of clear light that realizes emptiness?
I don't think they use that term. No. Mm-hmm. You know, they definitely talk about the consciousness and the mind, you know, but they wouldn't use that term.
So they have their own techniques, I guess? For...
Oh, well, they mostly would follow the perfection vehicle way of attaining Buddhahood, you know, doing the three countless great eons thing. Which I admire, I must say, you know. I mean, to have the endurance to practice three countless great eons for the benefit of sentient beings, I admire that. And then you can see how Vajrayana requires so much more to be able to do it quickly. It's not that Vajrayana is a shortcut. You get out of doing three countless great eons because that's hard. It means Vajrayana is harder than Paramitayana. Okay. So Vajrayana isn't just, you know, Manipemiyam. Okay, got some blessed water. Here's a long life pill. I'm all set, you know? It's not like that. Okay, so here's your reflection. The first turning of the Dharma wheel, which focuses on the four truths of the Aryas, forms the foundation for Buddhist practice of all three vehicles. Also, it specifically fulfills the needs of the Shravakas, those seeking personal liberation. So that's really kind of the Buddha, isn't it? I mean, that's how the Buddha is a great teacher. The second turning, which includes the Parajamparamita Sutras, and when it says Shravaka there, it includes solitary realizer, which includes the Parajamparamita Sutras, elaborates on the meaning of true cessations and true paths, and gives an extensive explanation of the six perfections. It is directed mainly towards spiritual aspirants who understand the teachings in the first turning and aspire for full awakening. The third turning contains two types of teachings. The first explains the naturelessness of each of the three categories of phenomena. It was taught especially for disciples inclined towards the bodhisattva path, who were not yet ready for the teaching on the emptiness of inherent existence. And the second explains Buddha nature and the clear light nature of the mind and leads disciples to Vajrayana. So that's the points to make sure that you really remember out of that section.
A question online.
Mm-hmm.
Someone asking whether, did the Buddha teach consort practice?
Yes. You know, in the Vajrayana, he taught that, and he also taught the requirements for a practitioner to be able to do that. Okay, so there's a lot of requirements before somebody's capable of doing that, and when they do it, there's a lot of tantric precepts involved that have to be kept very strictly when doing that practice. So it's not ordinary sex. It's not whoopee, you know, let's get together and, you know, think that we're holy and have some ordinary sex. It's not that at all. Okay? And people have to do a lot of physical and mental training to be prepared for it.
The person's just asking, did he practice it himself?
They say, not in the form of Shakyamuni Buddha. The Mahayana tradition says that the Buddha that appeared on the earth, he was already enlightened, and that he appeared as an ordinary being that practiced the Dharma and became enlightened in this life, because that made his whole life story as Shakyamuni, you know, Gautama and Shakyamuni, and, you know, progressing along the path. That made his whole life story a Dharma teaching. But the Mahayana says, in fact, he was enlightened long time before he appeared on this earth in the Nirmanakaya form of the Buddha. So in that way previous life, at the very end of the path, he did consort practice. Okay, but not in this lifetime. Okay. But the Buddha, when he was teaching Tantra, he appeared in the form of Vajradhara with consort. Okay. But that was an appearance for those highly realized beings who could understand Vajrayana. He did not teach Vajrayana widely to everybody in the marketplace. You know, and he didn't even teach it to all the bodhisattvas either. It was taught to just very select people, you know, because of the risk of people misunderstanding it.
Someone else is asking, why are there some visualizations of a deity by themselves, such as Chenrezig being alone, and then there's other deities where they're with a consort?
It usually has to do with the class of Tantra. And the consort practice is emphasizing more the, because there's four in the new translation traditions, there's four classes of tantra, and the consort practice comes in the highest yoga tantra, not even in the first three. Yeah, the first three usually have their single deities. And the fourth, they have them, you know, what Yabyung, male and female, and it symbolizes the unity of method and wisdom. Okay, so it's symbolic there.
How are the texts that the masters discovers, how are they categorized in terms of the tertians?
The tertians. They're coming. There's a discussion of it later in the chapter here. Okay. There's different kinds of termas that talk about all sorts of different things. So, but there's a discussion of them that's coming.
You talked about the third turning and the sets of sutras that are involved.
Mm-hmm.
Does the Tibetan tradition study the Tathagatagarbha Sutra and the collection of praises? Does the Tibetan tradition study the collection of praises by Nagarjuna?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and the sutra... you know, of the thought, you know, that the sutra, unraveling the thought, there's a lot of study of that one, because that's the one that lays out this whole thing about the three turnings.
I never hear about the Nagarjuna's collection of praises.
Oh, yeah, they're there. They're there. You can hear about them.
When I studied mind only from a Chinese Buddhist teacher, they would talk about the third turning as the definitive teachings, right? That when you heard, that if you were sharp faculty and you heard the second turning, you would know the Buddha's intended meaning were the three naturelessnesses. And then it's like laid out in full for the modest faculty.
Yeah, yeah. So that, I mean, that's the way that people present, because everybody wants to follow the definitive one. Yeah. So, you know, if you follow Yogacharya, if you follow, you know, Tathagatagarbha Sutra, then you say that's the definitive one. So, yeah, everybody wants to practice the definitive ones. So that's why Jay Rinpoche, you know, at the beginning of Lekshi Nyingpo, he has this huge discussion about what's definitive and what's interpretable. And the different the different tenet systems define those terms differently.
Two people are asking, if one day we practice highest yoga tantra, do we have to do consort practice to reach enlightenment?
To reach enlightenment at the very end? You can do it also in the bardo. So you don't need to do consort practice. You can attain it in the bardo as well.
If many of the fundamental vehicles, sutra, didn't go to Tibet, and a lot of it is based on, I think, commentaries, is it different in terms of the fundamental vehicle that's practiced in Tibetan Buddhism and the Pali tradition?
No, it's in most of the topics it's similar, because the Tibetan tradition, the commentaries that brought the fundamental vehicle teachings, if you study them, they've extracted, they have long quotations from the fundamental vehicle sutras in those commentaries. Okay, so you have a lot of, you know, the fundamental vehicle sutras in there. And and what was the second part of your question?
Are they consistent with
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're pretty consistent. There's some differences in the way emptiness or selflessness is explained, because the mostly in the first turning of wheel of the Dharma wheel, they talk about the emptiness of the selflessness of persons. There's only a few sutras that talk about the selflessness of phenomena. Okay, so, you know, from the point of view of the Sanskrit tradition, you know, those teachings on the selflessness of phenomena are in the first turning, but they're not prevalent and they're not all over the place, okay? But they'll point you to them, that where it talks about the body is like foam and feelings are like a bubble and, you know, that one, talking about the five aggregates. So that's the selflessness of phenomena. But generally, in the Pali canon, they're talking about the selflessness of persons. However, some of the smaller texts in the Kudaka Nikaya, you know, I read through them, and a lot of them sound like they're talking about emptiness to me. Okay, so, you know, you have the prevalent view that's spoken of, you know, predominantly in the four main Nikayas, and then you have all these other verses, you know, like they say in the first turning, he did talk about emptiness, it's just not the main thing, but those verses are there, and, you know, you read some of the things, and I'm going, wow, this sounds like Nagarjuna to me. Okay, look in Buddhism One Teacher, Many Traditions, in the chapter about selflessness, because I quoted, you know, put some of the verses in there.
Was rebirth taught in the first turning?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, quite obviously. I mean, the Buddha didn't lay it out and say rebirth exists, 1, 2, 3, 4, here are the points. That was more Dharmakirti. But the whole perspective, I mean, he'll talk about, you know, different, knowing different people in previous lives. There's a whole thing actually he did talk very explicitly in the Samyutta Nikaya, many sutras saying, you know, the number of times sentient beings have been your mother is inconceivable. You know, the number of if all the tears you shed in samsara over all your rebirths were collected, it would be bigger than the vast ocean. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely part and parcel.
Where does the doubt come in when people say the Buddha didn't teach rebirth?
This is people who themselves have doubt about rebirth, and they want to my view is they kind of want to cherry pick yeah? And they have the idea of modernizing Buddhism. So they say that, well, rebirth, the Buddha spoke of rebirth simply because that he was from an Indian culture and they believed in rebirth. You know, but no, I mean, if you read the sutras, the Buddha definitely, you know, accepted rebirth. Otherwise, if you don't accept rebirth, there's no reason for the Buddha to teach the whole path. If after you die there is nothing, then why do we need to practice the whole path and exert so much effort to practice the path? Yeah? After you die, there's nothing, there's no suffering, there's no person. Yeah? So then, you know, everything the Buddha did would be meaningless if there were no rebirth. Yeah? There would be no samsara. So you couldn't liberate living beings from samsara because samsara is the cycle of rebirth. Oh, no rebirth, no samsara. And maybe people are already liberated.
Fosa, Singapore, mm-hmm. is asking, did the Buddha summarize the 37 hominies, or is it arranged by later teachers? Did he teach the teachings in that order to help us progress along the path?
Yeah, he taught the 37 harmonies. They're all there in the, you know, in the Pali scriptures. Yeah. And then, of course, afterwards, the commentators, you know, gave, you know, elaborated, but they're all there. Hello, Fosa, Singapore. Greetings from everybody here.